Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We are beset with news out of the Middle East at the moment, some of it a function of some breaking developments, some of it a function of the aftermath of what I would describe as the debacle, the predictable, and if you've been watching this program, the predicted debacle of Joe Biden's visit to Israel and Saudi Arabia. We're going to talk about what has come of the latter and what is happening at the moment with one of our country's leading Middle East experts. He is, I'm proud to say, a member of our team at the Center for Security Policy. He directs our Middle East programs. His name is Dr. David Wormser. He brings to this conversation and to his work at the center a wealth of experience in the United States Navy as an intelligence officer and as a civilian in places like the State Department, the National Security Council, and in the Office of the Vice President of the United States. David Wormser, it's always good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure to be on with you, Frank.
Thank you. Let's talk first about the breaking news. I think with very little notice, we've learned this morning that Vladimir Putin is, for the first time in quite some time, I think since he went to China, as a matter of fact, and invaded Ukraine in February, is now making an international trip to Iran, where he is meeting not only, of course, with the mullahs, but also with a putative ally of the United States, the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. What are we to make of this trip, David?
Well, it's problematic on many levels. The first is that simply you see the divide emerging, where you have the United States going to Israel, Saudi Arabia, and sort of behind the scenes, there's UAE and Bahrain. And so you have a summit or a series of summits over the last week on the American side. So the Russians, the Iranians, and the Turks organize sort of a counter move. And you see Putin going to Iran at the same time you see Erdogan going to Iran. So this is deliberately a counterpoint to the American trip to say, well, there's another Middle East and we're challenging you. So that's, I think, on the immediate level of perception, that's what that's about first and foremost.
And Turkey, we found in a book we published at the Center for Security Policy back in 2018, really is an ally of the United States no more. I mean, yes, it's a member nation of NATO, but that's principally because there's no way to expel people who are no longer really performing as NATO allies. In this regard, David, we've just learned that the Turks are now reasserting their opposition to the addition of Sweden and Finland to the NATO alliance. What's up with that? And is this more of the haggling that the Turks, of course, pride themselves on? Or do you think this is a showstopper for that effort?
Well, it's partly haggling, but I would characterize the Turkish behavior more like hostage taking than haggling, in the sense that they are holding up the accession of Sweden and Finland into NATO based on the extradition of political opponents of the regime. So basically, they're trying to use and hold hostage NATO to their own internal political repression, rather than lighting a warning signal in the West that this is the Turkey you're dealing with, the repressive state now. They're actually now trying to leverage that to export their repression to foreign capitals.
Yeah. And presumably this would be something that Vladimir Putin would be delighted at if the prime minister, the now president of Turkey, Erdogan, wanted to curry favor with him. Putin, I'm sure, is very displeased with the prospect that these two nations might be added to the NATO alliance, and there may be rewards flowing from it for Turkey. Is Turkey in the market for Russian oil, as so many other nations are? And is this part of, if I could use the expression, a lubricant to this meeting, do you think?
Well, Turkey always needs oil and gas. It doesn't produce its own in any significant quantities to meet its demand. So, yes, it definitely has that always behind the scenes. The second thing is that it knows that Europe is now desperate, and it knows that Russia could shut down any pipelines from Azerbaijan or elsewhere that could flow to Europe with gas. So he needs some sort of strategic understanding with Russia, which could very easily shut down those pipelines. But I think even more, they both see the United States as the chief impediment to their both of them are unique in the sense that both of them now are the only countries in the world that have an overtly imperialist foreign policy. I'm not talking about nations that, like China, that behave imperially, but are still maintaining the fiction of being of language of respect for sovereignty. Russia and Turkey are the only countries that openly and explicitly advocate neo-imperialism. And the United States, they know, is ultimately the one that will stand in their way. So there's a coordination that ultimately obtains between the two of them.
Yeah. And of course, whether the Chinese say so or not, as you say, their behavior bespeaks this, and it's a basis for presumably this axis, if I could use that expression, being expanded. In fact, the Turks have said they want to become part of the so-called BRICS group, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. There are other applicants as well, but Turkey would be a big deal in that regard. And what might be the implications of that sort of being formalized, David? Would that mean they would throw in with one of the BRICS prime agenda items, which is trying to displace the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, another rather hostile act for a so-called ally?
Yes, I mean, I think that that's clearly one of the things that are going on. India is the interesting linchpin in this, in the sense that India had been drifting toward the West. But observing this administration and not confident that this administration will prevail either in the Middle East or in its struggle with Russia, the Indians are hedging now. So the weak link in the BRICS is now no longer such a weak link. They're now basically neutral. India has returned to being neutral, which means the rest of them, Russia and China in particular, can use the structure effectively to begin to create an alternative bloc to the United States. Mm. But make no mistake, I mean, at the end, this is really a Russian-Chinese bloc, mm-hmm. and then the rest will be added to it. But this is a major strategic threat to the West, and we see it being actually implemented in terms of gas sales and oil sales and strategic behavior.
Well, we're going to talk in a minute a bit more about the Iran piece of this, because it features prominently, of course, in the travels that Joe Biden undertook last week. But before we leave Turkey for the moment, David, I just wanted to say it does seem to me as though the upshot of the Turks repositioning here in this overt way not only bespeaks, as we'll talk about with Ben Baird a little later in the program, their ambition for spreading Sharia as their organizing principle for this supranationalist approach, but also their deep hostility towards this country. And we have to revisit their status as a member nation of NATO. After all, they're getting access to, intelligence and technology by having that arrangement, and it must not persist, it seems to me. A way must be found to punish them. That and more coming up with Dr. David Wormser on the other side of this short break. Be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Roger Robinson helped Ronald Reagan defeat the Soviet Union, the last totalitarian communist regime that threatened to destroy America.
Central to that accomplishment was a comprehensive effort to cut off the Kremlin's cash flow from Western sources. Today, Mr. Robinson is warning about what he says may be, quote, the largest financial scandal in world history, unquote. That would be the underwriting from Wall Street that's propping up an even greater threat, the Chinese Communist Party. He estimates between $3 to $6 trillion has been invested to date by U.S. sources in companies owned or controlled by the CCP. What's most scandalous is that thanks to financiers like BlackRock's Larry Fink, those sources include scores of millions of mostly unwitting American investors, among them now U.S. government and military personnel. Join a webinar today at presentdangerchina.org to learn how this enemy can be financially defeated, too. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're continuing a very, very topical conversation with Dr. David Wormser, one of our country's preeminent experts on all things Middle Eastern. We've been talking a bit about Vladimir Putin's somewhat surprise visit to Iran to hobnob with not just the mullahs who have ruined that country for decades, but also Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the increasingly autocratic dictator of Turkey. As opposed to the Turks, who are putative allies, David, the Iranians are, I think, unmistakably enemies, though you wouldn't necessarily know it from the way the Biden administration has been treating them. Just a quick word on what Putin is interested in doing with the Iranians, do you think?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think what Putin's interested in doing with the Iranians is to establish a structure through which Russia can freely trade and engage with most of the world without and circumvent the sanctions that are being imposed on him from the European side and the American side. So what you see in that respect is a deal, for example, that is emerging this morning, a $40 billion gas deal between Russia and Iran, where Russia will help Iran. Gazprom will come in and essentially take over the gas fields and will then develop them and make them more modern and up to state. The Iranian gas fields are essentially laying fallow because they don't have the technology and the means really to develop them. So Gazprom,
because of sanctions on the Iranians.
Because of sanctions on Iran. So essentially it's a quid pro quo. It's more than a quid pro quo. It's an alliance. It's an alliance of friendship between inimical forces to the United States. But there's also a quid pro quo, which is Russia develops Iran's gas field, but then Russia can export via Iran all sorts of things and circumvent the sanctions. And that $40 billion gas deal is a tremendous blow, because it's hard currency for the Iranians. It makes Asia ultimately, Asia will eventually out of despair have to turn to Iran for gas. Pipelines will be run from Russia to Iran under this deal. So Iran can also become a hub for export of Gazprom gas to China, say, and other nations in Asia. So what you're seeing is a reshaping of the oil and gas trade lines, based on the rising expectation of Chinese, Iranian, and Russian power and the declining fortunes of U.S. power. Yeah. And then the second thing is, I think it's a tremendous humiliation for the United States, because the primary purpose for the United States' trip, for President Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia, was tin cup in hand to beg for more oil and gas. And instead, he got nothing, basically, from what we now learn. And then Putin goes to Iran, and before even he lands, this major gas deal is announced. And such a juxtaposition of – and this ultimately is Russia's key point, which is, we're good allies. We'll stand by you. You can be an awful, horrible, murderous regime trying to annihilate Israel, the United States, and the West. But we'll stand by you as your ally. Yeah. Whereas the United States is fickle and doesn't. So your regime, if you're allied with the United States, is in trouble. And I think this trip and the juxtaposition of the oil deals and lack thereof on the Western side, I think is such a symbolic, and intentionally so, symbolic blow to the United States.
Well, as you say, that juxtaposition is no accident, comrade, the Soviet phrase. When you look at what else might have been signaled by this increasing partnership, if not strategic alliance, between Russia and Iran, presumably there's a pretty strong signal being sent to the Israelis. Don't even think about using military power against our new partners on the part of the Russians. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's basically a signal that Russia is now 100% behind Iran. This ambiguous world where Russia was Iran's ally and didn't want to take a blow in abandoning its ally, but yet still coordinating on many levels with the Israelis to avoid not only deconfliction, but there wasn't really a deep hostility between Israel and Russia at that point in the last 10 years. Now what you're seeing is Russia's full in with Iran. Iran is full in with nuclear weapon, a nuclear program. And that's it. We're now seeing a fight where Israel and Saudi Arabia and UAE now are left all alone, essentially, to deal with the Iranian threat, which is now the Russian-Iranian-Chinese threat emerging in the region.
Right, filling the vacuum of power created by yes. this administration, particularly in the Middle East. David, I did want to ask you about that the Iranians being all in on the nuclear program. I understand that a senior Iranian official has now said they have enough enriched uranium to make a bomb. They just have to decide whether they want to do it or not. And that presumably is part of their posturing and what's left of this diplomatic dance with the United States. But correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding was that heretofore, the Iranians had maintained the fiction for all this time that they weren't interested in nuclear weapons. They were just, you know, building up nuclear power for energy reasons, even though they're awash with other sources of energy. Does this mark a significant departure from that? Maybe not a surprise to those of us who know what the real purpose of this program has been all along, but still an interesting coming out party, if you will, in terms of what the Iranians are actually doing.
They're maintaining still a little bit of ambiguity. They walk back a little bit and they said, yes, we could, but we're still, there's a fatwa that bars us. There is a novel thing, first of all, in what that official said. He said not only they have enough amassed uranium, he went on further and said that essentially that they have the technology to build a bomb. In other words, they are saying they have the weaponization, the technological side of weaponization done. Whether that's true, I don't know, but it certainly declares intent. The second thing is this famous fatwa, which John Kerry and others constantly seize upon. There never was a fatwa. There never was
Remind us what a fatwa stands
well,
for.
Well, a fatwa is a religious announcement by a governor, a sort of a relevant authority in Islam that lays down what is religiously allowed. And in this case, there's this myth of a fatwa by Khamenei himself that says Iran will not pursue a nuclear weapon because it violates Islamic principles. There in that, and this has been a myth that has been used by Western leaders over and over again. And of course, the best disinformation is when you play upon the predispositions of your opponent. So the Iranians are playing upon us, and our predisposition are such eager desire to see moderation there right. that they're playing along, and they're not denying the fatwa. But the truth is, there never was a fatwa. Mm-hmm. There were other fatwas that were quite contradictory right. to that. That essentially. And there's a program.
And more to the point, there's a program, an active, ongoing program of building. David, in 30 seconds, you talked a little bit about the debacle in Saudi Arabia. Did Biden perform any better vis-a-vis Israel and the Palestinians?
Well, he did the typical thing with Israel, which is he said all the right words and all the symbolism was there when he was with the Israelis. But underneath, there was nothing. He basically told the Israelis we're pursuing the JCPOA, the Iran deal.
The deal with Iran.
And the Israelis were basically telling him, unless there's force on the table or even used, that's meaningless and dangerous. Mm-hmm. So the words were nice. The atmospherics were great. But the Israelis came out of this pretty much under the impression that the United States was not going to help.
Yeah, at best and at worst, perhaps be very much a part of the problem, especially now with this new correlation of forces with the Russians as well as the Chinese and Iran. And anything other than just more emboldening of the Palestinians? 5 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, he reinforced symbolically that the United States does not recognize Israel's sovereignty over places like the Western Wall.
A disaster. David Wormser, thanks for the work you do at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up, and I look forward to our further conversations about all of this and much more in the days ahead. I look forward to talking further next with Congressman Pete Hoekstra about, well, this new book, The CCP Is at War with America. Stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Back, and I'm pleased to say we are joined by one of my favorite people. His name is Pete Hoekstra. He has a whole host of titles that we can cite to. He was a member of Congress for many years, and he chaired the House Intelligence Committee. He has also been the U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands for a time during the Trump administration. He is these days, I think perhaps one of his most important distinctions, the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Advisory Board. He's also been the chair, or co-chair in this case, of another very important initiative of the Center for Security Policy called Team B3. And it is the team that authored this really important book entitled The CCP Is at War with America. Congressman, among other titles, let me simply say welcome, sir. It's good to have you back.
It's always good to be with you. Thank you, Frank.
I'm so excited about this product and that we've got really, I think, important insights into the nature of the problem that has been afflicting our country for the past 2+ years. You obviously understand as well as anybody the significance of the second opinion that the team gave to the official narrative out of the intelligence community that they just really couldn't figure out where this disease came from, whether it was naturally occurring or whether it was out of a laboratory. Just give us the essence of the findings once again, Pete, and then I want to talk with you about what's coming next out of Team B3.
Well, thanks, Frank. I mean, you know, the Team B project came out of a discussion that you and I had where I expressed my frustration and you shared it that, you know, the U.S. intelligence community, you know, we fund them to the tune of $80 to $90 billion per year. And their assessment of the pandemic, the COVID virus was, you know, we don't know where it came from. And we think that the Chinese government didn't have any foreknowledge. And you kind of go, wow, that's it? That's all we're going to get?
Right.
And so you and I, we have different sources, but we also have access to a whole range of experts. And we said, let's take a look at the data that we have and see what we can determine. And I think the two real key findings out of here are, number one, there's overwhelming evidence that this came out of a laboratory and didn't come out of nature. That goes counter to the narrative that was out there for a year, year and a half, that if you said that, you know, you were blocked from social media. You
canceled. Were,
you were canceled. Mm-hmm. You were part of the cancel culture.
Right.
Now it's become vogue to actually talk about that. But this, and the second thing is that there's, again, overwhelming evidence that the Chinese government, the CCP, weaponized the virus to create a global pandemic. And you say, well, you know, Frank, Pete, how can you guys say that? And it's very simple. As the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, was locking down massive parts of China, but most importantly, Wuhan, they were allowing Chinese, the Chinese people to travel globally. In fact, encouraging the Chinese to travel globally, doing what? Spreading a virus that they knew spread from human to human, even though they were denying it publicly, and they had the WHO saying the same thing, it can spread. So the two key findings, it came out of a lab. And secondly, the Chinese government had foreknowledge of this. And with that foreknowledge, they allowed and facilitated the spread of this virus to go global.
Yeah.
You and I would conclude what? An act of war.
Yes, it is indeed an act of war. Congressman, I'm really excited about an initiative out of our Team B3 and the Committee on the Present Danger China, of which we're both members, to ensure that this really important document doesn't become just another report sitting mostly unread on some dusty bookshelf, but actually can have impact on our country's attitude towards and response to the unrestricted warfare, of which this is really part of the Chinese attack on our country. Talk a little bit about the idea of briefing these candidates for elective office over the next 3 months with the findings of the Team B and committee, and the opportunity that this represents to perhaps, as I'm very fond of pointing out, getting us on a different trajectory, much as Ronald Reagan did in 1980, when he went to the American voters and said, you know, we need to depart from this idea that we can safely engage in what was then called detente, I guess it's called engagement today, with our mortal enemy at the time, the Soviet Union.
Well, you know, there's a couple of schools of thought out there right now, Frank. You know, there's been a group of business people, including the former president and CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, some leading political figures who say, you know, let the business community work out this relationship with China. It's all about the economics. It's all about the almighty dollar. And it's kind of like, no, that is a naive position. Our policymakers need to understand the threat that we face from China, whether it is the economic threat or whether it is a threat of biological warfare, in this case, an attack that has resulted in over a million Americans who have died. So briefing members of Congress, briefing candidates for the November elections and finding out where they stand. You know, are you in the school of thought that says, we'll work this out. You know, it's all about economics. And once we negotiate the right kind of trade deals and those types of things, will be fine, which is a terrible way of thinking about this. We've seen 20 years after China has moved into the WTO about how China operates economically. Yes. We need to give them a different perspective, but most importantly, we need them to come forward and say, you know what, if I'm elected to the U.S. Congress, if I'm elected to the U.S. Senate, if I'm elected as a governor, I'm going to take a tough stance against China And I'm coming at this recognizing that today China views America as a country that they are at war with. Where do our candidates stand?
Amen. You've served, of course, in Congress. You've been a candidate, including for governor of Michigan. You know how important it is to actually elicit from those who seek to represent us where they stand, as you say, especially on an issue as important as, well, war against our country. Congressman, I'm very excited to report to our audience that we've had a chance to take this briefing out for a spin, as it were. We call it The Brief, and both the Republican and Democratic candidates for governor of Colorado, respectively, Heidi Gandahl and the incumbent governor, Jared Polis, they've both taken the brief, both found it very compelling, I believe, and recommended that others take it as well. And I hope that we will have the ability to make sure it's as widely available as possible and look forward to working with you in that connection. Congressman, we only have about 2 minutes left, but I did want to ask you, you've mentioned the World Health Organization. You've been following closely what has been going on, the role that the World Health Organization played in this pandemic by, among other things, facilitating the adoption here, among other places, of the so-called China model for dealing with pandemics, something that had never been used before and, frankly, seems to have made matters a lot worse. Is a precursor, I'm afraid, of what the World Health Organization might have in mind for us if it gets still more power. Where do we stand on the prospect that it might yet get more power?
Well, I'm very, very concerned about the potential that it will get more power. You've got a Biden administration that has bought into the globalism and believing that many of our problems on a global basis can be solved not by America taking action, but giving our sovereignty over to these international organizations. We saw it with the pandemic, the World Health Organization and a number of other countries are pushing, and we'll see this over the coming months, the coming years, that they will expand the portfolio and the authorities for the World Health Organization. And, you know, there's other UN
including the United States government, as best I can tell, the Biden administration.
Oh, yeah. But there's other organizations now, the World, Environmental Foundation, again, an organization that comes out of the UN, telling farmers how and telling countries how to farm. Mm-hmm. We are seeing a country in Africa that, you know, their crops have been devastated. Why? Under pressure from the World Environmental Organization and European governments, they no longer use GMO seeds, and they're using organic fertilizer, which means their crops this year decreased by 85%. In the Netherlands, we are seeing, again, the same thing, putting farms.
I was going to ask you about the Netherlands. You've obviously served our country representing us there and hail from it. What's happening there, Pete, is a subject that we have to return to on another occasion. I'm afraid we're out of time for today, but this is a very real-time example of the overreach and the damage being done by these, not just these lunatic environmentalists, but also by these international agencies that advance their agenda. Congressman Pete Hoekstra, Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time today, as always, and your great service as the co-chairman of the Team B3. We'll look forward to our next conversation very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Ben Baird about Islamism on the march right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Roger Robinson helped Ronald Reagan defeat the Soviet Union, the last totalitarian communist regime that threatened to destroy America. Central to that accomplishment was a comprehensive effort to cut off the Kremlin's cash flow from Western sources. Today, Mr. Robinson is warning about what he says may be, quote, the largest financial scandal in world history, unquote. That would be the underwriting from Wall Street that's propping up an even greater threat, the Chinese Communist Party. He estimates between $3 to $6 trillion has been invested to date by U.S. sources in companies owned or controlled by the CCP. What's most scandalous is that thanks to financiers like BlackRock's Larry Fink, those sources include scores of millions of mostly unwitting American investors, among them now U.S. government and military personnel. Join a webinar today at presentdangerchina.org to learn how this enemy can be financially defeated, too. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and I want to welcome for the first time to these cameras and microphones a man that I've admired from afar for some time, but not yet had a chance to interact with. His name is Ben Baird. He runs a really important program at the Middle East Forum. It is about Islamism in politics, and it is a topic that I've been passionate about for some time and not been able to focus on as much of late as I would like. So we're delighted to have Ben with us. Ben, thank you for the work you do and for joining us to talk a bit about it.
Thank you, Mr. Gaffney. It's a pleasure to be here and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, let's talk a little bit about the work. What is the best way to characterize Islamism, first of all, and then Islamism in politics, particularly here in the United States?
Sure. Islamism in politics is a project of the Middle East Forum. At MEF, we like to differentiate between Islam and Islamism as being a theocratic worldview. You know, there are various ways that this is expressed, but often it involves some form of Islamic law, being part of government, or even really just being part of a very strong part of the social sphere as well. But at Islamism in politics, we pay attention to Islamist political activity at all levels of government, but we pay particular attention to local and state government, where Islamists have been operating with impunity without anybody there to monitor their activities or sort of look into what they're doing. We look at Islamist political candidates. We look at Islamist money in politics. We also look at lobbying efforts by Islamists and get out the vote drives. You know, they're very organized at all levels of government, and yes, at Islamism in politics, we mean to counter that.
Bless you for those efforts. Let's just refine this a little bit. You mentioned Islamic law. It goes by the name Sharia in the Islamic world. Sharia supremacism is, I guess, the way I think of what these people are about. Not all Muslims are imbued with this idea that they have to live according to Sharia wherever they are, and most especially that they have to make the country where they are, including this one, over in the image or model of Sharia.
Right.
But some do. And I think you're rightly focused on those Islamists, as you call them, that have that in mind. And there's an organization that is very much associated with this agenda. In fact, I think it's kind of its principal purpose is to promote Sharia supremacism around the world. And that would be the Muslim Brotherhood. And I know you follow it closely at MEF. You do an outstanding job of exposing what it is doing. Remind us what the mission of the Muslim Brotherhood is. There's a famous, what's called explanatory memorandum that was published by one of its top leaders some years ago, which makes it pretty clear it's antithetical to the character of our country, let alone its current formation.
Right. Now, the explanatory memorandum, which was taken off of a Muslim Brotherhood operative by the FBI in the 1990s, stated very clear that the Muslim Brotherhood was interested in taking political control very gradually of America by using our own democratic systems to do so. And the Muslim Brotherhood...
Sabotaging our miserable house by our own hands, as I recall, is sort of
that's
the essence
exact,
of it.
Yes, it uses very clear language where it's unmistakable that they are going to sabotage our system of government and use it, bend it towards their own will, which is a theocratic worldwide caliphate with America as part of that.
So let's get down to some particular cases. You have been reporting on the first American city that is now governed by an entirely Muslim, and I think in this case, Islamist city council and mayor. The mayor of Hamtramck, Michigan, in particular, a fellow by the name of Amir Galeb, has made some rather extraordinary statements, having professed during the election season that he was going to be governing for all citizens of Hamtramck. Doesn't sound like that's actually his agenda. Tell us about it.
No, not at all. As you say, we became interested in Hamtramck when, for the first time, it was governed by all the city government is entirely Muslim run. Six city council members and a mayor by the name of Amir Haidara Galeb was elected in January of 2021. You know, this is a city that is 2 square miles. It's an enclave surrounded by urban Detroit. And we wanted to know, is this an Islamist government? And in taking a closer look at that, we found that Mayor Galeb has said really some horrendous things. He's made anti-Black statements, anti-Semitic statements, and even appears to have admitted to a serious case of voter fraud during the 2020 Democratic primaries.
No kidding.
Yes.
So right. When you put this all together, the thought that occurs to me is this is kind of a problem. Where are all those who are worrying about white supremacism
right.
When you're witnessing a man in public office, no less, yes, local, but still a city in our country, professing anti-Semitic sentiments, racist sentiments towards Blacks and others, and among other religions, he's disparaged, I gather, Christianity.
Right.
This would seem to be a problem, and yet it does not, as far as I can tell, get anything like the attention that it deserves. Ben Baird is our guest. We're going to take a brief break here and come back to discuss whether this is not just a problem for certain people in Michigan at the moment, but perhaps for the rest of us, and especially to the extent that it bespeaks a larger tendency. A tendency, a policy approach, a predisposition, if I could use those terms, towards a kind of Sharia supremacism that is totally at odds with our national interest and, I would argue, our national security. That and much more with Ben Baird of the Middle East Forum right after this. Welcome back. We're having a really important conversation about Islamism, or Sharia supremacism, if you will, in America, brought to you by, among others, the Muslim Brotherhood. We were talking about Hamtramck, Michigan, a city that is now governed by an all-Muslim government, and the mayor is exhibiting some pretty unsavory tendencies. To what extent, Ben, would you say this is an isolated phenomenon, and perhaps alternatively that it might bespeak certain impulses that are evident more broadly in this community? Again, not all Muslims, but the Sharia supremacist ones for sure.
Right. I mean, these are certainly supremacist views, first of all, that Mayor Golub is exhibiting. He shared an anti-Black meme that is very popular on white supremacist websites, and he basically mocked George Floyd protesters. He liked posts that referred to African-Americans as animal and inhuman. He liked a post that referred to Jews as monkeys who tax the very air that we breathe. I think this is typical of what you see in these Muslim enclaves across America and larger metropolises like New York or places in California. They are very part of the democratic infrastructure of those cities. But in places where they have a majority, they do not hide their supremacist views. They're very out and open about these. Hamtramck fought to have the Islamic call to prayer heard publicly as far back as 2008, when they had about half the number of Muslims that they currently have today. They have fought to take gay pride flags down. In fact, they just did so again very recently. So these views that they hold exhibit, I think you'll find in other places, other Islamist enclaves, places like Dearborn Heights, Patterson, New Jersey, and places all over the country that you wouldn't even think of that have basically become Islamic enclaves. You can go there, but it's definitely feels like a different country.
The Muslim Brotherhood has spawned a lot of infrastructure in the United States, as you say, in some of the cities that you've mentioned, but elsewhere as well. Islamic societies typically are the brand that they do it under, with mosques and so on. Another organization that they've created is the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations. And you've written a piece at Islamism.news, Ben, about Muslim Day on Capitol Hill, where this organization, the USCMO, as it's known, sort of flexes its muscles with the various front organizations the Muslim Brotherhood has established, notably the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America, the Islamic Society of North America, and the like. And what we're watching, I think, is the Islamic Muslim Council, for example, as well. We're watching, I think, an effort made to sort of mainstream these individuals as representative of all Muslims. And yet, I don't believe that's true for a moment. Do you?
No, they are not representative of all Muslims. However, they hold the political power in America. They have the microphone. If anything happens with the Muslim community in America, the media will go to these groups that are part of the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations to get their opinion on what happened. So they've sort of position themselves as the spokespersons for Muslim Americans everywhere. And they're not. They are Muslim Brotherhood, and they also, USCMO represents a number of other extremist movements from around the world, including the Jamaat-e Islami movement in South Asia. You even have W. Dean Muhammad's follow-on from the Nation of Islam movement as well. So it represents a diverse range of Islamist factions that certainly do not represent all Muslim Americans. However, I think we do have to acknowledge that there are a large number of Muslims that do agree with them. Otherwise, I don't think they would be able to hold on to the political power that they have.
Well, that's an interesting question, and I don't know for sure the answer to this question, but it does seem to me as though one of the ways in which this outfit, the Muslim Brotherhood, has been able to both build this infrastructure and convey the impression that it speaks for lots of Muslims, and for that matter, may indeed be recruiting a lot of Muslims to its cause, is the foreign help that it has received. Long-time supporters, the Saudis, the Qataris — the Saudis have now broken with the Brotherhood, we're told. The Turks have now stepped up and are a prime sponsor, as I understand it, of the Brotherhood's activities, including using Turkish facilities, mosques and the like, to support and enable meetings and planning sessions and heavens knows what all else in this Sharia supremacist model. This is of particular importance is at a moment when we're hearing Vladimir Putin is going to go meet with the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And I think this simply further confirms that he is no friend, no ally, for sure, of the United States. Your thoughts on both the role of these foreign supporters and sponsors and what their actual agenda is with respect to the future direction of our country. Are they seeking a Sharia America, do you think, as well?
Right. So, you know, originally the Muslim Brotherhood kind of grew out of Egypt, Saudi Arabia then, up until September 11th and a little bit afterwards, was funding all sorts of Islamist projects here in the United States. But Turkey has definitely stepped up most recently. The U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations is certainly a Turkish proxy. During its Muslim National Muslim Advocacy Day, attendees got to stay at the Diyanet Center of America, which is essentially Turkish President Erdogan's high court in the United States.
Yeah. And one of those facilities that I'm talking about that's sponsoring, yes, exactly, and enabling the Brotherhood. Ben, right, we've got so much more to talk with you about, but we don't have, sure, the time to do it today. I hope you'll come back to us with updates on all of this very soon. In the meantime, keep up the great work you do at the Middle East Forum. God bless you.
Absolutely. I look forward to it.
Thanks to the rest of you for participating in this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to do just that, and that you will now go forth and multiply.